It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You know, in 5 years, we've gone from trade war to tech war to early stages of a new Cold War. That high-octane fuel can be easily ignited by a spark. Taiwan, South China Sea, China's unlimited partnership with Russia, global recession. Any one of those are sparks that when you are embracing increasingly intense false narratives could lead to an accidental clash.
Hello, Stephanomics here, the podcast that brings you a new year in the global economy and a new year's aspiration that we end 2023 in better shape than we've begun it. Maybe I'm sitting on the wrong side of the Atlantic, looking at the wrong kind of grey sky. Everything's just feeling a bit grim. But we're going to break out of that gloom now to offer you some fresh insight into the central issue of our time, one I make no apologies for returning to on a regular basis: China's place in the global economy and its relationship with the US. Stephen Roach is a longtime contributor to the China debate. He has a new book out, and you just heard a taste of my conversation with him. But before we get to that lofty discussion, our senior US economic policy editor, Chris Anstey, wants you to look inside the box your new trainers came in.
You've probably never given much thought to desiccants. Not many have. But last year, those little packets you find in a box with a new pair of shoes were at the center of an international trade row.
So a desiccant is the little packet that is included in products that are shipped, and it's intended to take moisture out of the air. So, for instance, it prevents mold buildup or humidity getting to a point where it can cause damage to the product.
That was Bruce Main, president of a small safety consulting firm in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It turns out that China proposed a new production standard for desiccants last year that critics like Main say would have created a huge burden on manufacturers around the world. Suddenly, anyone making anything with a desiccant inside would be forced to worry about those little gel packets complying with a new standard. Shoemakers, for sure, but also producers of food, electric products, textiles, artware, and leather goods, among others. The battle over this most obscure packaging item illustrates China's growing ambitions, not just to dominate manufacturing, but to have a much stronger say in how products are made and traded around the world. Put it another way, the next round in the great global trade war between China, the US, and Europe may be waged by wonky government bureaucrats and design engineers over global standards. Here is Emily Taylor, an intellectual property lawyer who now heads Oxford Information Labs, a cyber intelligence consultancy.
The Chinese approach, which seems very daunting, very organized, long-term and patient. And in response, you know, it can feel like we need to up our game in the West, that China has understood that in many standards organizations, it's a numbers game. It's about putting people on planes or sticking people in a Zoom room and having lots and lots and lots of submissions. And, you know, in response to that, the West really seems to be scrabbling around at times and lacks that coordination.
When most people use products and services, they don't give much thought to standards that govern how they're made. You might use the term gold standard or substandard, but what are standards? There are scores of different standard-setting bodies for everything from pharmaceuticals to electronics. These global standards organizations were developed over the past century and more by company representatives, technical specialists representing big buyers, and civic groups, basically insiders that got together and settled on the most efficient, cost-effective way to make things. Of course, the whole process has been dominated by the West, with an outside presence of American and European representatives. Now, enter China, which unsurprisingly wants a say in setting global standards rather than simply accepting what others have decided. Last year, the Chinese government put out a game plan for strengthening China's hand in standard setting. It's been dubbed China Standards 2035, which gives a clue of the target date that they are aiming at. Bruce Main, the Michigan safety consultant, shared concerns about China's designs on the lowly desiccant.
Those of us that were involved said, not certain it really matters what the desiccant is made of, or it just doesn't work. I mean, is it effective in doing what it's supposed to do in terms of pulling moisture out of a package or preventing humidity from building up? And the size, the shape, the testing of a desiccant isn't necessarily something that we need a standard on. We certainly don't want to spend time, our time and energy, trying to write those kinds of standards. So that's why we did not support that effort.
In the end, U.S. representatives helped to kill off that desiccant proposal. But it illustrates concerns for standards to potentially become used as a tool for influence. And it reflects broader worries in places including the U.S. and Europe about China's intentions. Probably the most contentious area of standard setting is the field of technology. Taylor, the intellectual property lawyer, has looked closely at China's rising role in standards development organizations. Last year, she set up a group called the DNS Research Federation to shine a light on standard setting as it applies to the internet. Among the group's concerns is the way China is trying to push a new set of internet protocols, or new IP, that differs significantly from the open approach that underpinned the original structure of the web. The fear is it could be a cybersecurity risk.
Although surveillance takes place on the internet today, absolutely it does. There are many human rights violations. But the internet was not designed for surveillance. What we see with new IP is a network that is actually designed and optimized for surveillance, whether of a domestic population or through data sharing laws domestically, perhaps internationally as well.
Some of the tactics deployed by China in standard-setting bodies have alarmed many observers, like when Chinese representatives show up in numbers in an effort to boost the chance of Chinese proposals winning adoption. But not everybody is convinced that China is wielding undue influence in standards. After all, Western nations do want China to continue to participate so that global companies don't have to deal with China's standards being different from other markets. Olya Kanievskaya is a fellow at Stanford Law School with a forthcoming book on standard setting in information and communication technology. She argues that Western stakeholders are a little bit premature in their dire assessments of China's recent forays into standard setting, given that Western nations still dominate the process.
Standardization system that is open, that is consensus-based, that doesn't exclude stakeholders, is the system that we need for the technology to work. So I would be very worried if such initiatives to exclude particular stakeholders, be it China, be it Huawei, be it particular European or American companies, if such initiatives would actually make it to standard-setting bodies and would be adopted by them.
But especially when it comes to technology, there's increasing danger of two separate economic spheres developing. On one side, the West, with its own set of standards. On the other, China and other non-democratic regimes. The U.S. and European Union last year set up a new cooperation forum called the Trade and Technology Council. One of the items on the agenda? You guessed it, coordinating on standards. Nothing dry about this subject. In fact, maybe it needs a desiccant. I'm Chris Anstey for Bloomberg News.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
So, having had that brilliant micro-level example of the way China's role in the world is changing, we're going to go extremely big picture now with Stephen Roach, who will be a familiar figure to anyone listening who's taken an interest in the global economy, and especially Asia, over the past few decades. An economist, former chairman of Morgan Stanley, he is now a senior fellow at the Paul Tsai China Center at Yale Law School. He's written a lot over the years about the future of the US and China, and that's the subject of his new book, Accidental Conflict: America, China, and the Clash of False Narratives. Stephen, very nice to have you on the show and to see you again, if only virtually. We are seeing a lot of books about potential conflict between America and China, but what's your specific take?
In the past 5 years, Stephanie, we've gone from a trade war to a tech war, to the early stages of a new Cold War, a ominous escalation of conflict that did not have to happen had it not been for the false narratives that both nations embrace toward the other.
So I guess we should dig into that a little bit. How do you see those false narratives developing? And how do they affect their relationship going forward, do you think?
Okay, let me just answer that question in two parts. One, why do both nations have this penchant to embrace false narratives? And what are some of these key false narratives? My thesis in answering the first one is that both nations are surprisingly vulnerable in terms of their economic prospects, as well as their stature as leaders in the world. And the politics at play in both nations. And for example, you know, Joe Biden gets elected a couple of years ago, razor-thin majority in the Congress, but a strong bipartisan anti-China view that allowed him no wiggle room to disengage from Trump's China policy. So he, on his first day in office, repudiated a number of Trump's most unpopular policies, like the border wall construction in Mexico, the Muslim travel ban. But he did nothing to change China, because if he had done that, he would have been skewered by his own party, let alone the Republicans. Xi Jinping has a similar political calculus, aspiring for great power status. The U.S. Is viewed as the greatest impediment to his political objectives of this nationalistic China dream. So both nations have strong motives to blame others for their own vulnerabilities. The second part of the question is, what are some of these false narratives? I have 8 chapters in the book that detail false narratives split evenly between both sides of the conflict. The one I'll focus on from the U.S. side is we blame China for our trade deficit. Nations have trade deficits because they don't save, and the U.S. right now has the lowest domestic savings rate of any leading nation in history. And when you don't save and you want to grow, you import surplus savings from abroad, and you run massive current account or balance of payments deficits that drive multilateral deficits with many nations. In 2021, the last year we have full data for, the U.S. ran trade deficits with 106 nations. China was the largest, but by no means the only one. But by blaming China for our trade deficit, just as we blamed Japan 30 years ago for very similar reasons, I might add, we are ducking the big issue that we need to address to fix our own vulnerable economy, and that is a shortfall of domestic saving, a classic false narrative. The Chinese side is, you know, equally, if not even more culpable. The one I'll single out for you is China recognized now nearly 20 years ago that it needed to restructure, rebalance its economy, and shift from an economy that was reliant on exports and investment to one that drew increasingly on consumer demand. They haven't done that. They blame that on America's stated policy to contain China's peaceful rise. The U.S. does have a containment policy that is aimed directly at China, and that's a key theme in many aspects of my book. But America's efforts to contain China have literally nothing to do with China's own inability to rebalance its economy to be driven more by internal private consumption. China's dropped the ball on this for a number of reasons that I detail on the book, but by fixating on U.S. containment, they're guilty of an egregious false narrative with respect to the U.S.
I think as an economist, you do more in this book, I think, than most people to show the interconnections between that great power rivalry and the macroeconomic imbalances that opened up between us and China once China's growth took off. And as you've just explained, you end up with this sort of what you call a codependency with the insufficient savings by the US being matched by this massive trade deficit and, if you like, excess exporting by China. And you've just highlighted there, in a sense, what each side has done wrong in failing to kind of get to grips with that. But I'm interested going forward. I mean, there is obviously an element of this, which is just about China getting stronger, but continuing to be very different from the US in terms of its values and the kind of global order that it wants to participate in. And the US increasingly thinking it should try and thwart that development, having kind of given up on China becoming more like the US. So I just wondered, how does that sort of classic view, which says, you know, the US was hoping that China was going to become, you know, like Europe, but it's not like Europe. So now it has to just stop it being providing a rival economic system for the world.
Not so sure that the U.S. wanted China to be like Europe. I think the U.S. wanted China to be like America. And this is, a hopelessly naive expectation that was framed around the time of China's push for WTO membership that took over a decade to negotiate, finally culminated under President Clinton in late 2001. And his argument that he made to the Congress is, if we don't allow China to join our system, then others are going to benefit from China's extraordinary rise. And by binding China to an American-centric trading system under the WTO, its compliance with those rules would pretty much turn it into a system that mirrored ours. That was just hopelessly naive. And this is a Washington failure, as well as a European failure, and probably a Chinese failure as well, lies at the heart of this conflict. The notion of coexistence, which is something that Henry Kissinger, still as he's nearing 100 years old right now, continues to stress as the ultimate resolution for the U.S.-China conflict, needs to be much more open than it has been under this sort of false premise of mirroring one system's values with the other.
I was working at the U.S. Treasury just as that deal was being finalized at the end of the 90s. And I guess the debate was had about whether it was realistic to expect China to be on anything like that trajectory. I guess the question arises of what's the alternative? If you're Donald Trump, or indeed some in the Biden administration, that was the sort of original mistake, was to let China into the World Trade Organization. But I'm not sure that you're saying that was a mistake. You just think we should have told ourselves a different story about it.
I don't think it was a mistake at all, because, you know, by engaging China and bringing China into the WTO, that was a powerful driver of Chinese economic growth at that time, and really powered its export-led momentum. And from those exports, you know, income-constrained American consumers are able to expand their purchasing power over low-cost and increasingly high-quality Chinese goods. China became the largest purchaser for a long time of U.S. treasuries to enable us to fund our budget deficits. And the Chinese market, as our America's third largest and most rapidly growing export market over the last 12 to 15 years. So there were huge benefits that occurred. And I think the mistake we made is that we wanted more. We expected China to transform its system in a way that matched not just our economic needs, but our political and social value system. And, you know, there was reason to hope that that was occurring under the sort of Deng Xiaoping model of a market-based socialism, where China was certainly taking on and opening up to a lot of Western values. But then along came Xi Jinping 10 years ago, who reversed course on virtually all of that count. And we've taken enormous exception to that.
Listening to you, the way you describe China's motivations and its different outlook on the world, and indeed talk about coexistence, you know, many would say that the title of your book sounded a bit odd, because it doesn't sound like the conflict is accidental at all. I mean, you have a new rival power in the world, which has very different views of kind of basic notions of whether it's press freedom or human rights, democracy, any of these things. I mean, it's sort of inevitable that they will come into conflict with the West, broadly speaking, who believe that these values are important, isn't it?
Well, certainly two very powerful nations, you know, one the ruling hegemon, if you want to call it, for lack of a better term, and the other a rising superpower. There was always the possibility of conflict and friction. The concept of accidental conflict says that by embracing false impressions, false narratives of the other, we build on these mistaken views that we harbor that are politically expedient for our own purposes. And the false narratives collide, they duel with one another, and they have the potential to become the high-octane fuel of conflict escalation. And again, back to the first sentence I uttered to you today, and that is, you know, in 5 years we've gone from trade war to tech war to early stages of a new Cold War. That high-octane fuel can be easily ignited by a spark, Taiwan, South China Sea, China's unlimited partnership with Russia, who is now waging an unconscionable war, America's own vulnerabilities, global recession, which is a distinct possibility this year. Any one of those are sparks that when you are embracing increasingly intense false narratives could lead to an accidental clash. I mean, just a few days ago, I saw a report, I'm sure as you did, of a fighter jet over the, a Chinese fighter jet over the South China Sea that came extraordinarily close to an American aircraft. Accidents can happen, and big wars, world wars, have been started by accidents in the past, and so I chose that title to express that potential in the context of this conflict.
But those are genuine reasons why we might conflict with China. They're not false reasons. China wants to take back Taiwan, which, as far as we can see, does not want to be back in as part of China. It wants to have an unrivaled supremacy in East Asia, where we have, and the US has, powerful allies and security relationships. So is that a false narrative to be that China does want to take over these things and we don't want to let them? That seems to be the sort of uncomfortable truth.
Those are legitimate areas of dispute. One side believes strongly in, and as does the other. I'm not arguing that those are false, but what I'm saying is that the confluence of these false narratives makes dispute resolution over legitimate issues all but impossible. I do end the book, you know, with a prescriptive approach to resolve disputes in the context of a conflicted relationship. The current architecture of engagement between these two leading superpowers is completely dysfunctional. The nations don't talk to one another. When they do talk, it's Zoom calls, or there was a 3-hour plus meeting in Bali ahead of a G20 meeting in November that accomplished nothing. And I make a fairly detailed proposal for a new organization that I call a U.S.-China Secretariat, a permanent organization located in a neutral venue that is empowered to address all aspects of the relationship, from trade and economics to technology, cybersecurity, human rights, health, fully staffed by equal complements of Chinese and American professionals, working full-time, 24/7, on all these and other aspects of the relationship to frame problems, provide mutually authored policy white papers, sometimes with dissenting views from one another, from one side or the other, but stressing a collaborative approach toward dispute resolution rather than the current contentious approach that we have right now. This relationship needs a far more robust platform for engagement, and this may not be the perfect suggestion, but it sure as heck beats what we've got now.
Well, it's interesting that, I mean, we've talked to quite a lot of people about this issue over the months, and they all, whatever direction they come from, they all end up with a version of what you're talking about, or there's a way of starting to rebuild trust, because that's one of the things that we worry has really gone by the wayside. We're going to run out of time, but I had two more questions for you. And one of them, and it will sound a bit self-interested since I'm sitting in the UK asking this, but I wonder whether you did think there was a role for Europe in helping to reduce the false narratives and potentially rebuild trust. And the reason I say that is, although obviously the European Union has been, if you like, on the US side of many of these disputes, it's also been much more reluctant than the US to see this as a zero-sum conflict, and somewhere like Germany is obviously very torn about and very concerned about the possibility of a decoupling of the global economy. How do you see Europe's role? Is it completely just a bystander in this and how this relationship evolves, or could there be something more constructive that Europe could contribute?
Europe is certainly not a bystander. It's a an important actor in the global economy, in the geopolitical arena, and does have, I'd say, more mixed feelings about its relationship with China right now than is evident, certainly in the United States. The U.S. administration, however, has been putting a lot of pressure on its European allies to take sides in this dispute, and that's an uncomfortable place for Europe to be. But I think Europe has ample leeway to chart its own course with respect to China and to point out that some of the issues that the U.S. takes as such a close to an existential threat in the technology arena, for example, are things that Europe is handling very differently. And I would cite the Huawei-centric U.S. fixation on the Chinese technology threat. Huawei still has a significant presence in many European telecommunications sectors. Huawei has been investigated assiduously by the UK, by Italy, and by other European economies, and the egregious threats of espionage that the U.S. just takes for granted through Huawei's state-of-the-art 5G telecommunications infrastructure have never been validated. There was one instance of a backdoor leak in Italy a number of years ago that Huawei was quick to resolve. The Italian telecommunications providers have actually increased their reliance on Huawei since then. So I think that technology, which is such a major aspect of the growing conflict between the U.S. And China, is one that the Europeans could play a very constructive role in mediating and pointing out, I would hope, a more constructive outcome.
That's fascinating, because of course there'll be lots of people very focused on this issue clamoring as they listen to this to say that the European position represents a naive view of Huawei, and there's always that point that's made that even if it's not happened yet, you know, there is a legal requirement for any Chinese company, if asked, to provide information to the government, especially under Xi Jinping. That's been quite clear.
Yeah, I think the idea of trying to wall off one nation, one system's platform from another because of the difference in systems that we've addressed earlier is the taking decoupling to its most destructive endpoint. And I think we need to avoid that.
My final question is a bit more personal, Stephen. I mean, as long as I've been thinking about the global economy and sometimes and writing or reporting about it, you have been an observer and an analyzer of the global economy, but also US and China particularly, and having spent a lot of time in Asia, obviously. I just wondered whether, looking back, I mean, what have you changed your mind on? I mean, when you see how the world has evolved relative to what we might have thought, say, in the early 90s, how have you been surprised? Have you changed? I mean, you obviously have changed your view in some important ways, both with regard to US and China, in light of events.
Yeah, I have. It's been a journey for me. I would say... The perch I had at Morgan Stanley for 30 years was really, a great sort of learning experience for me. For the first half of that, I was U.S.-based, focused on the U.S. economy, which is something I did at the Federal Reserve prior to coming to Wall Street. And I was heading up the global economics team, and then along came the Asian financial crisis of the late 90s. And you know, I'd been to Asia a lot and I'd been to China a few times, but I had no idea really what was going on inside. I had a hunch that China would really shape the end game of what was then the worst and first crisis of globalization. Little did we know, but that's the way we thought of it then. And it quickly became evident to me that China was cut from a different cloth and would come out of the crisis much better than the rest of Asia, especially Japan, which had been the leader. And so I switched my role then. I became a global economist fixated on Asia, especially on rising China, and eventually moved to Hong Kong and headed up Morgan Stanley's Asian businesses. And, you know, I was really convinced that China's transformation along the lines of the Deng Xiaoping model was really going to lead to a powerful, unstoppable engine of new engine of global growth that could benefit the West as well as itself. And then, as I indicated earlier, along came Xi Jinping, who's reversed much of that with his fixation on ideology and control that has had limited the consumer-led rebalancing at a time when China needs it the most. China has an aging population, and the working-age population is already contracting. And so when you have a contracting working-age population, to stay the course of growth and prosperity, you need an acceleration of productivity growth. That's the economist in me. And under Xi Jinping, productivity growth is going the other way. And so China's in trouble, and that has really been a tough pill for someone like myself, who has been a diehard China optimist, to swallow.
Stephen Roach, that's a hell of a note on which to end, but I think we will try to do that. Thank you very much for your time, and thanks for your book.
Thank you, Stephanie. Great talking to you, as always.
That's it for Stephanomics. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, please rate us wherever you get this podcast and check out the Bloomberg News website for more economic news and views on the global economy. You should also follow @economics on Twitter. This episode was produced by Yang Yang, Summer Sadi and Magnus Henriksen, with special thanks to Stephen Roach and Chris Anstey. Mike Sasso is the executive producer of Stephanomics.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.